You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Royale. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And the synopsis for tonight's show is the Enterprise investigates the wreckage of a 21st century Earth spaceship orbiting a distant planet and the appearance of a casino with inhabitants based on a rather poorly written paperback novel. This is the 12th episode of Season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original air date was the 27th of March, 1989. It was written by Tracy Tormey under the name of Keith Mills, because there were some issues around rewrites, and it was directed by Cliff Ball. It features a special appearance by Diana Muldaur as Dr. Pulaski. It guest stars Sam Anderson as the assistant manager, Jill Jacobson as Vanessa, and Leo Garcia as the bellboy. Special appearance by Noble Willingham as Texas, and co-stars Cole Meaney as Chief O'Brien and Gregory Beecroft as Mickey D. So, what do we think about this episode? Now, I don't know about you, Lou, but we've been away for so long that I really enjoyed this, and I'm not entirely sure whether I really enjoyed it because it's a great episode or it's just because I haven't had my fix for Star Trek for the last 4 weeks.
That explains my indecisiveness, too, because it's like this is a terrible episode that I really kind of like.
I don't know. I hear you. I really do hear you.
I'm not sure if I'm supposed to like it or not, really.
I think it's unique enough, right? This kind of thing doesn't get done that often in Trek. I think it's a little it's not the greatest episode in the world, but it's for what it is, for this kind of like weird concept. I think it's good, and it has a lot of nice moments in it.
Okay. Well, before we get to that, how about some forums?
I think so. I think people have been, I'm sure they're waiting for it.
And worse, we'll talk about what's been happening lately, but let's do the forums first. So let's start off. We left off with, where did we leave off? A Matter of Honor. And this one is by Kieran McDuff, which you wanted to tell him where you just heard Kieran McDuff recently. Why don't you tell everyone where?
Oh, okay. So, I mean, for anyone that hasn't already picked this up, Kieran McDuff makes a guest appearance on the 10 Forward podcast, another podcast on, you know, on Trekmate. He is the latest Desert Island Trek guest that they've had on. So it was, I think, just came out just around the Christmas time. So certainly check that out if you haven't done so already. Some pretty good picks and a lot of love for the TNG, which we always appreciate.
Absolutely. And I have not heard that yet, but I am looking... Oops, I accidentally hit the play button on it. But I am looking forward to hearing that. So sometimes we wonder, how do our listeners sound? And you've already pre-warned me that he's got the Scottish on, so I'm looking forward to that. Aye, lad.
I don't think there's any aye, lad, but yes.
No. Okay, aye, lass. Whichever you want, it doesn't matter. So anyway, hold on just a second, because I just decided to download that show right now, in fact. Okay, so he starts off by saying, I think I'm right in saying that I wasn't the biggest fan of Heart of Glory from Season 1, as I didn't think it was an especially exciting episode. However, I do appreciate that they were trying to give the Klingons a bit more depth than we'd seen in the original series. The episode carries that on, and in my opinion, does a far better job of it. Anything outside of original series, Klingons is better. Or are better, whatever. I really enjoyed the insight we get into the Klingons through Riker's eyes, and I agree with Lou, it wouldn't have worked well with any other character. I really appreciate the subtle aspects of this episode, like Riker trying gach on the Enterprise, but only finding it should have been served alive while he's on board the pah. Do you like that? The gach and the pah. Anyway.
Klingon poetry.
The gach and the pah. By Lou. Anyway, the good nature on board the Pach was another aspect I really liked in this episode. The mess hall scene was fantastic and probably the best instance where we see that there's really more to Klingons than meets the eye. The camaraderie is very evident and exactly what you would expect to see. If the whole point of the exchange is to realize just how similar we are, then this does a fine job of it. Unfortunately, I don't think the other side of the exchange program worked too well. Putting Mendon in a Starfleet uniform makes things very confusing. Is he from the Benzite fleet, or is he from the Academy? It's not as if Riker gets dressed up in Klingon armor when he's away. Although, I'll admit it, that would have been amusing to see. Agreed. Mendon also come across as quite arrogant, and the implication is that because it's a cultural Benzite trait. So, how come Mordok came across as almost nervous at times? If they're from the same geosphere, surely they should be very similar characters as well, at least from a cultural aspect. Or is the implication wrong that it's just a Benzite cultural trait, and it is? In fact, just Mendon being a bit smug. I don't know. What do you? I think it's kind of a little bit of both. I would say two people that are from the same geosphere could be very different people. And I think Mendon was just very nervous because of the test he was facing.
Yeah, we also have to understand that. So which one was the one from coming of age, right? He would have been, you know, a younger kid just going up for the exams.
Right.
Whereas the other guy's, you know, come out the other end of that and is an officer, at least on his own ship. So I suspect, that guy's probably had a bit more experience and time to get smug.
Oh, right. Yeah, he's actually, I bet you Mendon is a very commendable officer on board the whatever Benzite ship he's on aboard. But, you know, and like Picard says, we should have explained this better at your indoctrination. Well, actually, I think maybe he probably shouldn't have been on the bridge in not such an important position if he has no schooling of Federation techniques anyway. So, but that's a different thing. I'm not sure we agree that the ending felt a bit rushed. I think in this episode, the pace builds up quite nicely with the mystery and the tension reaching a peak just at the right time. I actually think the rushed feel is intended and probably adds to the tension of the episode as things look grim right up to the last second. I think the only real criticism I'd have for this is that I'd like to have more of Riker on the Klingon ship. I think to do that would have been needed to be a story arc rather than a one-off episode. And we don't really get those in TNG in the same way as we did in Deep Space Nine and Enterprise. One of the Enterprise 3 episode arcs from Season 4 would have been ideal, I think. But at least we do revisit the exchange program later in the season. There are a few holes here and there, but overall, it's a strong episode. And as I said at the beginning, it's really good at giving Klingons depth. I'd give this one a 4 out of 5. And let me pull that up to find out. To remind ourselves what we gave. I gave it a 3.5. You gave it a 4.
I think I gave it a 4. Yeah, I seem to remember that.
Yeah, and Mark gave it a 4.5.
No, of course, Mark Stamper joined us that week.
Anyway, thank you, Kieran. And hopefully you'll grace us on our show.
Okay, now over to Captain Proton, and I'm going to get it in here. Okay, so wow, I was not expecting James, who I know for certain enjoys a more real universe feel to the show, to have such issues with the phaser range. I do understand this scene had direction issues. For one, of most of the scene is focused on two of the men's faces, and the two effects were substandard. and this may force your reaction to the scene to be more negative light. But to question why the phaser range exists. Now, by the way, just I had no recollection of this when I was reading it to myself, which is why I then come up with a comment later. I feel like I'm noticing a general social trend here, putting the cart before the horse. Now, I know everyone who is anyone has seen Janeway and Seven playing Velocity on the holodeck, but that was a decade later. The holodeck of this sophistication is brand new technology aboard a brand new ship. Brand new is more often about novelty than functionality, so I can fully understand why the ship designers did not throw all their eggs in one basket and ditch all the tried and tested methods. As a matter of fact, you can even say to yourself, look at all of these holodeck malfunctions so far. Thank goodness that not everything recreational is funneled through the holodeck. I'd be too scared to have fun. Let's not let our future knowledge negatively or positively impact what's going on here and now. The show evolves beautifully. Let's watch it unfold in awe rather than disappointment. Now, I don't think I was hugely negative about the phaser range existing on the. I think I was, wasn't I? I had a bit of a moan on that one.
Hmm.
I didn't want to come across as hugely negative. I thought the scene was more out of place than anything else. But hey, we've got another phaser range coming up in a couple of episodes' time, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. So. We'll see whether or not I'll be a calmer person at that point. Anyway, he finishes off. So, by the way, you can ask yourself the same question as to why military men and women are required to practice at a target range. In Iraq, it is estimated for every single casualty suffered by adversary combatants, a staggering 250,000 bullets are fired. So Star Trek's 10 phaser fires per victim a stun is a step in the right direction. Keep practicing, boys. It's paying off.
Is he talking to us or them?
I think it might be directed at us.
Well, I don't know. I just kind of thought the phaser range was unnecessary when it could have been done on the holodeck. And, you know, maybe like, I don't know, little lights, having to shoot at little lights instead of maybe something more real. I don't know. Nah, I don't know. I honestly, it's been a while since I don't even have a recall what we even said about it, to be honest. Okay. All right. Let's go on to the final one. Is that the final one, Doc?
You mean from Data Logan?
Yes, Data.
It is.
What does Data have to say? He says, many thoughts about Klingon aging and lifespan.
At least he's starting by being honest.
Yeah.
This is indeed many thoughts.
Oh,
but I apologize.
Carry on. It's clear the writers chose to make Klingons grow up more rapidly than humans, mostly because stories were more interesting and easier to film with older Alexander and actor. There's reference in Star Trek Insurrection to Klingon puberty being significant, another nod by the writers about how Klingons grew up really fast. Worf talks about Joktila, which Picard translates as puberty, but for Klingon, that hardly does it justice. I don't really think that explains the fast growth. That just means that when they get pimples, they're just like huge. So I guess puberty is just a whole big adventure in Klingon than it would be in human, I suppose. I don't know if that necessarily equates to time span, though. But because there have been a lot of young Klingon characters, this idea that Klingons age rapidly is fairly easy to integrate with known Klingon characters. The problem is that the other young Klingon character we know about, Worf, seems to have not grown up the same way. Very inconsistent with the writings of Klingon biology here. References to the childhood of Worf, a fellow Klingon, tend to talk about his growth rate as if it was comparable to humans.
And he just jumped in there, right? I mean, he grew up with a brother, as far as I remember. He grew up with Nikolai.
Yeah.
And it always, I don't know if there's an explicit reference, but it always felt that they were of similar age and of similar, you know, interest as they went through their lives. So it wasn't as if there was a 2-year-old playing with a 15-year-old. And then also, if you then look at Worf's adoptive parents, the Roshenkos, again, I don't think there's anything explicit on, you know, on the record, but it seems reasonable that they are, you know, comparable to his biological parents' like age, I would have thought. So I think that, I suspect there's a slight inconsistency here.
Yeah. Well, I guess. Well, anyway, he goes on to say he was discovered on Kittimer when he was only 5, and he references Sins of the Father. Although in the earlier TNG episode, Heart of Glory, it is just described before the age of inclusion. When he was 7, he beat up some Klingon, some teenagers. That's referencing family. And he was playing soccer with the other kids when he was 13. But these doesn't make a lot of sense if he aged like Alexander. That 7-year-old boy would have already looked very much like a teenager to us, and the 13-year-old Worf would have been a fully grown man. No wonder he was able to beat up teenage boys or accidentally kill them in a soccer game. The only way to explain this is that references to Worf's childhood had been converted into human terms. So when Worf was discovered when he was 4, maybe he was really 1 year old, but looked 4 to human eyes when he was giving teenagers bloody noses. Do you like the way I did that? Bloody noses. He only looked 7, but was actually 4. Glaring at the teenage boys, all of them with bloody noses. Oh, so anyway, it's clear that from all the evidence shown on screen that Klingons mature quickly, becoming adults in only about 10 years. And also Klingons live to be well over 100. That's, of course, from Blood Oath.
Okay. In the TOS book, Final Reflection, some of the differences between Klingons and humans were discussed, including the fact that Klingons can't see the blue end of the visible spectrum, but can see more infrared than humans. This is why their ships seem to be so dark and red to humans. Actually, I hadn't heard that, but that's an interesting observation. I don't remember if it was stated that Klingons had shorter lifespans, but that's always been my personal belief. Shorter life races tend to have shorter childhoods.
Well, yeah, they have shorter lifespans because they're killing each other all the time.
Do you think really without the war, you think a Klingon would live like 400 years, and it's only because they end up killing each other that they get killed off by 60 or something? It's always been my personal opinion / thought on this. The Klingons, up until quite recently, were a very short-lived race. Puberty at 5 to 7, mature adult by 9 to 10, average lifespan of 20 to 25 or something like that. It would go a long way towards explaining the more militaristic aspects of their society. A Klingon, at least amongst the warrior caste, has to win significant victories in glorious battle to gain fame and, quote, live forever through the songs sung about you. And only recently has their Klingon lifespan significantly increased, Korn, Kang, Kor, and Koloth being some of the eldest Klingons ever in history, as seen in DS9's Blood Oath. This recent change in lifespan could just be due to medical advancements, but I also think that it would be interesting if the lengthening of the lifespan was due to the human augment DNA that infested the Klingon Empire and also made them have smooth fore ridges for a while, as seen in the Enterprise episodes Affliction and Divergence. Because Klingons were suddenly living longer, their population skyrocketed and caused a strain on their resources. Initially, they combated that by being even more aggressive, partly to fight for more resources, but also partly to allow more Klingons to die in battle, since they weren't dying of natural causes as much anymore. Hence, the more aggressive Klingons in the TOS time frame. And only later, after the society has 100 plus years to adjust to the new longer lifespans, do the Klingons start to experience more social reforms, as seen in Star Trek 6 and the TNG Klingons. The only real conflict, my theory, in canon is the second season's Enterprise episode Judgment. This is before the augment DNA affected the Klingons, but the Klingon character Kolos stated that he had been practicing law for 60 years, which would tend to support the idea that the Klingons were already a long-lived race, relatively prior to the augment DNA situation. Oh well, just another time when Star Trek TV writers, while good at character development generally, are not as imaginative when it comes to the possible sci-fi aspects of the show. The books written earlier about the Klingons were more interesting than the stuff written for TV later on. I still like my explanation about the Klingons. sorry, excuse me. I still like to use my explanation for the Klingons in my own viewings. Oh. And actually, I think that made a lot of sense there. So thank you for your thoughts on that one, Data.
Absolutely.
And I particularly like the idea that I did enjoy the Enterprise, reasoning behind the smooth-headed Klingons. And I think that, yeah, I mean, if you have been infested in that way, I think you could certainly start seeing a new features crossing over into Klingon society. And if that is part, you know, the aging as well, I can buy that.
I thought it was an interesting storyline, actually. I thought it, you know, gave a lot of explanation as to how it happened and put Dr. Phlox in the middle of it. I thought it was pretty brilliant, actually. But, yeah, to each his own. But I still feel cheated, never have seen the first gay Klingon. I just would like to know how that would go. You know, I mean, what would he be like? Certainly not warrior. Then again, I guess he could. No, you know, that was pretty lame to say, but still, okay. Anyway, thank you guys for the comments. And before we get into the show, let's get out a couple things I want to mention. Sometime a little bit before Christmas, I received a package from the United Kingdom. And no, it wasn't the doctor sending his first book that he wrote. This one came from Jason. Do you remember Jason, me talking about Jason Lehman?
I do not. Can I take that as a rhetorical question? Because I do not recall.
Oh, that's okay. No, Jason was he's a listener of the Lou Trek Show. He was a very staunch listener. He loved the show. When we first met him, he was catching up with all of our shows. And, you know, we would talk about him on occasion. And hopefully he's received or he's heard some of those that Brian and I talked about. But last year, when we lost our Min Pin, it was very tragic, as you probably remember, the way she died, and it was just so, so sad. And so he asked me for a picture of Minnie, and so I sent him a digital picture over the internet, and his wife, Tori, I think a baby short for Victoria, took that picture and drew a beautiful little canvas painting of Minnie. With her, you know, her collar, her dog tags. It was a beautiful, such a beautiful thing. And we've put it in our living room on the wall. And we actually moved our memorial for Minnie into the living room. We had it in the hallway, and now it takes a corner of our living room space. And the painting is right there with it. I've sent a picture of it to Jason, and I think I may have put it online. If not, I'll put it in this show. I know I'm choking up here, but it was just a beautiful thing that he did and she did, and I just want to put it on the show. Hopefully he will hear this, and I want to thank them from the bottom of my heart for that. Now, let's bring it back a little funnier. And ask, why have you been keeping from me a comedy skit called Mrs. Brown's Boys?
Is that directed at me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to make a statement here.
Oh,
I am aware of Mrs. Brown's Boys. I have never watched a single second of it. I steer away from it.
I can imagine. I don't think it would be for you. I could certainly imagine that. I saw a skit of it a couple years back, actually, floating on Facebook, where Mrs. Brown had some curry and it didn't agree with her, so she's like going to the bathroom all the time, and she has to get out this aerosol spray, you know, the pine one, to make the house smell a little better. A little bit later, her son comes in with this aerosol glue can that she wanted. And so she comes out of the bathroom, or the loo, I guess, and she just grabs this can and starts spraying it into the air, not realizing it was the glue. And from there, it just gets hilarious. And I don't know. I think it's funny. It's raunchy. That's probably why you don't really get into it, but I think it's freaking hilarious. Some of the skits they do, and she is played by a man, no less. So, but that's okay. Anyway.
No, by the way, there's no judgment here at all. It's just something that I've not watched. I think culturally, I know of it, and in particular, I know about the lady being played by the man. By the way, there was a film recently about it as well. Yes. I think they actually managed to get it to a movie, and the reviews of it were pretty dire.
Really?
But I'm sure that's just a bunch of movie critics being snobbish about kind of like a gross out comedy or whatever it might be.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you know, she curses a lot, but I'm not sure if she's really using the real word or a sound alike when she says her words. So I don't know. I just kind of found it hilarious. Just anyway. So if you haven't checked that out, guys, go to Facebook or go to YouTube and check out Mrs. Brown's Boys if you want. That's up to you. So now we haven't been here forever. Why have we not been here forever? Because back in November, a girl that would do my job when I was off on Friday and Saturday left to go to sales. And since, you know, we had nobody to do my job when I was off, I was filling in. I'm a loss prevention specialist. I'm the only full-time one there. Then there's a guy at night who takes my place. And then on the weekends, we use security officers to come in and fill the role for loss prevention specialist. And it takes time to learn our 300 and some cameras that we use, know where everything is, be able to follow people on camera. It takes a little time, a little finesse. Plus, I get calls for cleaning crew, maintenance guys. I'm the general 411. Hey, what's the phone number for Joe Blow? Because somebody doesn't want to look through the directory book, so they just call me. When there's a tornado warning, I go through hell. You know, let's see, medical calls, frauds. I'm watching somebody. They look like they're going to, you know, looks like a fraudulent situation. I get involved in that. Tape reviews. There's just so much to do that it takes time for people to learn. Well, the guy they hired after her decided he didn't want to do that job no more. He stepped aside and another guy got hired. Well, he actually was a Trekkie. I thought, hey, you know, we got someone here. He hadn't heard of our show and he was going to check it out. So now I don't know if he listens to this or not, but you're a pudwack. Sorry, I don't mean that.
Don't call the listeners a pudwack.
Okay, one out of 14 listeners is a pud. Basically, this guy decided he didn't want to do it. He got another job. He just stopped coming in. They called him and said, oh, yeah, by the way, I quit. That's why I call him that. So since November, I've been working 6 and 7 day weeks. I just put in the last 15 days straight through since Christmas I've been working. And so now we have another new person that actually was a security officer, wants to take over that job on the weekend. So now I'm training him. Yesterday was his first day. We got a couple more Fridays that I'll be working. But basically what it came down to is when I got off of work, it was almost 10, 11 o'clock your time, and I just felt like I couldn't make you wait till 10, 11 o'clock, till you wouldn't be done till almost, 2 or 4 a.m. So that wasn't going to work. So we had to put the show on pause. But the good thing is that recently I've been to court probably 4 or 5 times in my 8 years in loss prevention, my current role. I've never had to testify. The person that I busted for shoplifting would see my file there, and they would just always plead out. Well, we had a girl just now. I got her for shoplifting a small little coin purse with the Nebraska Cornhuskers logo on it. And I had this girl in 3 different camera angles stealing this product, and she still insisted that she didn't do it. Well, anyway, as it turns out, the judge found that I was credible and she wasn't, so he ended up hitting her with a $300 fine, which that's quite a bit, and court costs. So that was interesting. So what about you? What has been happening since November for you?
Well, I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, obviously I have a bucket load of kids, and it's just been extremely busy when, you know, as the children come and no longer go to school, it's obviously very busy. We've obviously also had Christmas and New Year between the last time we spoke. So it's pretty much been, it's pretty much been a very busy time in the Roberts household. I've also worked straight through effectively since last time we spoke. So, you know, I've not had any time off over Christmas, New Year. And we've had a couple of instances of, you know, some of the kids getting a bit of a tummy upset bug, and that being spread around the family. Unfortunately, when you have four of them, you can almost always guarantee that at least one of them is going to be ill with something at some point. And they just pass it on, and it's, you know, it goes in a nice big circle of contagion. But it looks like we're now coming through the end of things, and looking forward to the new year and getting back on with the Battle Bridge, because I think it was fortuitous, but we broke exactly halfway through season two. It was exactly in the middle.
Wow. Yeah. See, and I know what you're saying about the bug going around. While you were just saying all that, I was building me a little snot web here. So I just feel.
So I heard.
You couldn't have. I put it on mute. It still went through.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, it won't be on the show. I apologize for that. As long as you can put up with it. I remember when Brian Dedamore used to just belch out of nowhere. Anyway. And he'll be on here in a few weeks, so you'll get to experience that perhaps. Okay, so here we are. Here we are at the Royale. Unless we have anything else we need to discuss.
No, let's roll into the Royale.
Captain's log. We're visiting Theta 8. That reminds me of a joke. There was a star system that was really overweight. Welcome to the planet that Theta 8. Oh, I don't get it either. But seriously, the Klingons might be sniffing glue. I say that because supposedly they found pieces of a destroyed ship in the upper atmosphere. Why they think we give a fired phaser is beyond me, but we shall investigate it. Log out.
Okay. The teaser is full of so much good stuff that I want to talk about.
Go for it.
First of all, apologies to everybody. And secondly, I don't read this stuff off Memory Alpha. I do nerd off the top of my head.
Right.
But the planet that they found, Geordi specifically mentions the temperature, and the temperature, and it is called out also on Memory Alpha, is below absolute zero. Mm-hmm. So for anyone that doesn't know, there is an absolute bottom to the temperature. You can't go beyond. So when you effectively, everything is stopped, there's no energy at all. You're in the, you know, bottom quantum state. You are above the temperature that apparently this planet is supposed to be at. So the lowest possible temperature is in the 270s. This is supposed to be in the minus 270s. This is minus 291, and that's not correct. And then another one, which is not quite hugely unrealistic, but he also claims that the wind is something of the order of, you know, over 300 meters per second. That's pretty much the speed of sound. And that's a very windy day.
Right. Well, you know, that's my second number two point here. To be honest, everyone, let's be honest for a second. When Geordi was telling Riker about how nasty it was on the planet, who here was able to concentrate on what was being said versus who here was checking out the hot little ensign behind Riker?
Really?
You didn't notice her with the long hair?
No, no, I was going scientific inaccuracy of the week.
That
yes.
must be. I think that was. There's no – well, that, yeah, you're right. That is a scientific inaccuracy of the week because there's no way Riker could possibly be standing next to that girl and not have his hand on her. So I don't think they – obviously she wasn't named. I don't believe I could check out the guest stars or co-stars or uncredited co-stars. So let's see if there's anything in the uncredited co-stars about the girl with the long hair. Oof.
I don't think there is.
Nope, there isn't. Oh, but we did mention fail to mention Laura Walsh as the cocktail waitress. But I guess that's really irrelevant. Okay, let's talk about this. Let's talk about mathematics for a bit. And this, I'm going to let you take the field.
I'm proud of you. I'm really proud of you for this.
Absolutely. Fermat's Last Theorem, published by Andrew Wiles. Using advanced 20th century mathematics, Fermat's original proof is still unknown, and for some mathematicians, the question has never been, it never even existed. So now that it's been proven, can you give me some kind of ballpark as to what they're talking about?
So what are you asking for? Are you asking for the thing that is referenced by Picard in the episode?
Right.
Okay, so do you know Fermat's Last Theorem?
Not specifically, no.
Okay, so let me tell you something that is interesting. If you take the number 3 and then you square it, so you times it by itself, you get the number 9. Mm-hmm. And then if you take the number 4 and square it, you get the number 16. And if you add up the number 3 squared and the number 4 squared, when you said 9 plus 16, you actually get 25,
right?
Which is exactly 5 squared. So that's interesting. So 3 squared plus 4 squared is actually 5 squared.
Right.
Now, okay. Fermat's Last Theorem says that you cannot do that for, instead of squaring it, if you were to cube it, so if you were to multiply it by itself and then multiply it by itself again, you cannot put together a set of whole numbers where that equation holds. So, you know, something cubed plus something cubed cannot be equal to something else cubed where all of these unknowns are whole numbers. Now, he went even further than that, and he actually said, it doesn't matter whether it's cubed. If you raise it to the 4th power, it still doesn't work. To the 5th power, it still doesn't work. In fact, any number of times that you're raising these numbers to a certain power, if it's above 2, it simply will not work. You cannot find 3 numbers raised to a certain power above 2 that are related by a to the n plus b to the n is equal to c to the n. And this is something that was known about. Actually, when I say known about, you can kind of look into this yourself by just writing down a couple of numbers in your favorite, you know, looking for patterns, and you'll see that there are lots of common numbers that happen to solve this for when n equals 2, like 3, 4, 5, and things like that. But for the other ones, they don't exist and they can't very easily be found. Now, to prove that they can't be found is a very, very, very hard question. And at the time of the writing of this episode, no one had ever proven that these can't be found. Now, it later transpires that someone did provide a proof that these can't be found. And I think it was like, you know, something like 3, 4, 5 years later or so. So technically, Picard being in the future, he should have known about the proof that someone would have put forward in like 95 or something like that.
Right.
But having said that, I think a get out of jail free card here for the series is that the proof that was put together is not a simple proof. It is a pretty hard and very involved proof. So to the extent that that might be undone, it's possible. It's not likely, but it's always possible. This isn't, you know, there are very few people in the world that would even be able to read the, you know, the proof of the theorem. Now, the thing that makes this story really nice is that back 800 years ago, or 500 years ago from our perspective, when Fermat put together and he hypothesized this, it is true that he wrote in the margin of his notebook, he wrote words to the effect of, you know, I can solve this and it's really, really interesting, but I'm not going to leave you the information here. So when he wrote that, he knew how to prove it. A lot of people started thinking, well, he's either must be a genius or something, you know, or he must have some type of more understanding than what we have. Now, as time goes on and people aren't able to solve it, it looks more and more like that he actually didn't have a proof. But there is this romantic idea, right, that he did have a proof, but we've just not been able to find it for X number of 100 years.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Everybody got that? Good. And I figured out why you were hearing all my coughs and stuff. I was muting the wrong microphone, so
it wasn't. Were you even muting me?
No. I mute my microphone when I cough. At least I tried to, but I was muting the wrong one. That's why you were hearing it all. So it was good of you to carry on like that.
Actually, one thing I'm going to call out the card on, by the way, is that, yes, you know, as a mathematician, every now and again, you do want to sit down and, you know, stare at a computer screen and try to solve Fermat's last theorem. That's very unrealistic. It's not something that you are going to have a huge amount of insight on when just staring at an equation. In order to solve maths theorems, well, a theorem, by the way, a theorem is something that is proved. So you don't have to prove theorems. You have to prove theories. But when you prove the when you are sitting there trying to prove something, you're certainly not just looking at a sheet of paper. There's a lot of, like, you know, number crunching and grinding going on.
Okay. Well, as long as it makes sense to you, I'll accept that. Cool?
Okay.
All right. Okay. So then they do find something in orbit, and so they beam it aboard, and it turns out to be a flag of the United States with 52 states and a thing of NASA. So I can't help but wonder, where will those two states come from? I mean, is there actually,
I was going to ask you. I was actually going to suggest who are the other two states? Mm. I mean, between now and the mid-21st century, do you have plans to invade, you know, both Mexico and Canada?
That's possible. They'd be the biggest states in the Union, but I guess it's possible. Or do you think maybe there's a landmass that's floating our way and no one knows about it? You know, little chunk of Cuba that just busted off and is heading our way. Meet up with Florida soon.
But I mean, possibly. And I did get callbacks on this to the original series, and I don't quite know whether it was. I think it was like the Changeling. They have a very similar tub of reveal in the transporter room. You have this thing beam aboard, and you know, the interest in writing is on the opposite side so that the characters can't see it. And they have to walk over to it, turn it to the camera, and it goes, da, da, da.
Yeah.
It's very original series-esque.
It is, in my mind. That makes sense. Okay, so now they're scanning the planet again, and they find a building that's smack in the middle of a what did he say? There's a breathable zone right in the middle of this planet that shouldn't. It makes no sense. Assemble it away, team number one.
Yes, I like the way that Picard mentions that, oh, I suppose we can send, you know, a small away team, you know, a tiny away team, and go, okay, well, send the second in command, the third in command, and the security chief. You know, you would have thought at least, you know, we'll see how safe it is first. Send, you know, Ensign Ricky down, and, you know, the dude. You know, the dude that's really not got a huge career in Starfleet. Send them down first.
Bridge Dance and Ricky. Ah, crap. I'd be so afraid if I was a lonely ensign to hear that bridge to whoever. Ah, crap. Okay, so do you have any idea why Data beamed down without a phaser? Or did you notice?
Oh, I didn't notice that he beamed down without a phaser.
Phasers on stun.
Well, you wonder why they need phases at all, right? If they're going, I mean, effectively, this is a very strange setup. It's you know, a complete planet of hell, and, you know, a small little dot of an oasis there that is a breathable zone, and there are no life signs, as I don't think they mentioned. So, you know, I don't think they're going to be finding anyone down there.
No.
But I didn't notice that Data came down unarmed.
Yep, he just had a tricorder. So they beam down and are standing under an ammonia storm, and then next to them is a revolving door. Nothing around the door, just the revolving door. And it's revolving. So what do? Let's go on in.
I have to say that, and I've mentioned this before, that I did see a lot of, I did see TNG when I was very young. And this episode I remember watching on first run, or at least on the initial run before I was probably old enough to appreciate Trek. And this is this particular scene when they are in this like black room and walking into the, you know, the one revolving door that's standing there by itself. Mm. It is something that I remember from the first watch. So from when I was, you know, 10 or something like that. And I do think it's a spooky kind of weird, surreal kind of thing, right? It's not your usual bread and butter Star Trek. And, despite everything, and I think there are things wrong with this episode, but I do appreciate it. I do appreciate the effect it had and the mystery behind it at this stage.
Well, I think the background sounds probably led to it too, to making it a little more mysterious.
Oh, I specifically do have comments later on in the show when there's a bit where kind of like the tension turns up a lot and you find that you're trapped and, the music really kicks in and it does, it does guide you in the direction of feeling that you're very, 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 very trapped. And I think they did a good job on this episode with what they had. I did read after I had made my notes about how they had to turn around this show very quickly and that they didn't have as much money as they would have needed to put on something of this scale. And apparently it meant that they had to make it a lot more smaller and more claustrophobic. But I actually think that is to the show's benefit, certainly when we get into the second phase of people being trapped. And I think that they do very well with what they have.
Right. Okay, so they find themselves inside the Hotel Royale. At first glance, there's a few table games, but we later see a craps table, which, I'm a craps man. See, you said you've never been in a casino, so you still don't know what you're missing.
No, I have no idea.
I'll take a few quid and go play. It can be fun. But of course, if you've got an addictive nature, then be careful. Because it can get too much. Okay, so let's see, it's time to check into the hotel. And they've been expecting them. A trio of foreign gentlemen. Now, obviously, the Klingon ridges doesn't phase any of them. So what do you think they see Worf as?
Well, I don't think you can start asking logical questions like this.
Yeah,
I suppose. Because do they see Worf as Worf, and how do they react, and are they programmed to react the way that the humans would have reacted had they seen an alien pop down? I don't think the episode really holds up to that kind of scrutiny. I do have to say though that I really enjoy Worf in this episode in particular. I think he has some of the funniest lines, and he's a deadpan guy that just doesn't quite get a lot of the cultural references and so on. And I like the way that he interacts with the people. In particular, I think it's that, when they go to check in and, they'll say, so where are you from? So we're from the United Federation of Planets. And he goes, yes, of course you are, in a very straight way. Yeah. And then the big one is when they ask him about, what planet is this? And he's like, oh, I beg your pardon. So what do you call it? I call it Earth. What do you call it? So we call it Theta 8. How charming.
How charming.
It's really...
Yeah.
I shouldn't like it as much as I do.
Yeah.
But I like it.
How did a being like you get here? Yeah. So what do you think of, I guess you could call it almost the B-plot story of the bellboy and Rita? I mean, the music comes on and you get this feel of, oh goodness. What do you think of that that whole story?
Okay, I'm not a big fan of the genre that is, you know, from the book that's being portrayed. I don't really, I'm completely agnostic to the story of these extra characters. I really don't care one way or the other. I know that, you know, I know that it has to pause the interaction that has to go on between, you know, our heroes and getting out of the hotel.
Yeah.
But I think it's nothing more, and in a similar way to the scenes on the Enterprise, I think it's nothing more than just allowing you to cut away so you can cut back to the main action, which in my mind is, you know, Data, Worf and Riker exploring, solving the mystery, and a nice bit of comedy with Worf and Data being like fish out of water.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now it's time to get down to business. No, no, not that business yet. No. It's time to bust out the tricorder. Say, wait a minute, partner. None of these people are real. Why would that surprise any of them? I mean, we're on a planet. We're inside a building on a planet that shouldn't exist. Why would they think these people were human? None of these people are real? I mean, did they seem a little over-surprised that none of these people were real?
You mean like Worf and Riker and people?
Right.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. You would have, you know...
No, I'm sorry. No, why was Riker and Worf, and including Data, so surprised that the people in the casino weren't real?
No, exactly. You know, it would have been... Surely it's more surprising for you to beam down to a planet that's below absolute zero and has, you know, supersonic, nearly supersonic winds, and you're in a space that's completely isolated with one big door that you walk through and you magically appear into a casino from Earth's past. It would be more surprising if these people were real.
Yeah, right.
It would be astonishing if they were real.
Yeah.
You know, if they were actually living there. I mean...
Right. This ain't DS9. No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I can't believe that all three of them were shocked to find out these people were not real. You know, take this creature, for example. he has no DNA structure. Look who's talking. Man, you sound just like my ex-wife. Okay, now it's time to get down to business. Okay. So how you dealing with the story so far? That's why I say... I'm not sure if we're really supposed to like this or not, but for some reason we do.
Oh no, I'm sorry, I love it. I think it's just so I mean, I don't know, do you guys have the term left field in the US? It's just so out of nowhere that you beam down to a planet and there's nothing there and you walk through a door and you're immediately in, like, you know, you would expect latter TNG to start and also, you know, when you're into DS9 and you're into Voyager, you would expect them to start teching it up very quickly. Mm-hmm. So they'll be saying, well, this must be an illusion, this must be a holodeck, it must be something else. You'd be scanning for anomalies and stuff. Whereas here, they walk through a magic door into a magic world and they just accept it. And it's, I wouldn't want this kind of stuff every week, but it seems to be a break and a very unusual story, and it's entertaining enough, and the mystery is good, to be honest. I feel the mystery is good, that I'm kind of washed along with it, and I don't think I should be, but I kind of am.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, you're right. I like the casino aspect too, myself. So Data visits Texas at the blackjack dealer. And I was watching the dealer pretty close and comparing his actions to what I would see today. And I got to say, he was terrible. He couldn't shuffle. I mean, it was like he didn't know how to shuffle very well. So now, since you've never been in a casino, do you at all know how to play blackjack?
Yes. Now I'm aware of the rules behind blackjack.
Okay. Well, I thought, well, why not go ahead and I was going to do a little training how-to for everybody who doesn't know what blackjack is. And I had a couple observations. So Vanessa has a 15, the dealer showing 10. Now, if you're not familiar with the casino rules on blackjack, here's the small tutorial. Small as, you know, whatever. The term blackjack actually is a British slang for what we would call crazy eights. So now, having heard that, is it? Do you think it's still the same game you're thinking of? Because I've never heard of Crazy Eights. I don't know what that is.
No, never heard of Crazy Eights. But I recognize the game from when Data describes it as, you know, or I think he has it described to him as you have to hit 21 without going over. You right. have up to 5 cards, and you have to beat the dealer.
Yes. Yes. Well, here in the U.S., the dealer draws 2 cards each to each player and to him or herself. Both the player cards are face up, so you see the value, while the dealer's first card is going to be face down, which is called his hold card. The dealer's second card is face up. That tells you what you want to use for strategy. If the face card up is a face card or a 10, he uses a little mirror on the table to see what his hold card is. If it's an ace, he's got 21, the game is over. Everyone loses unless you also match his blackjack or 21 on the first handout. And that's called a push. No one loses, no one wins. The dealer did not hit 21, then begins a round of asking players, do they want more cards? If Vanessa were the dealer, she would have to hit on 15. The dealer must hit everything from 2 to 16 and stand on everything from 17 to 20, because 21 you'd win. So if the dealer's up card is not a face card but an 8, the game goes on. After each player analyzes what the dealer is showing and what they have, they either hit or stand. And the object, like you said, is to get as close to 21 without going over. So if Vanessa got another card and it was a 6, she's got 21, but not necessarily blackjack. Blackjack is a natural selection of an ace and 10. If Vanessa's next card is a 7, she would have gotten 22. She's busted out. Vanessa's next card was a 5. She's got 20. She's still in the game. Okay, so Texas had a 9 and a 3, which gave him 11, and then he got the 10, and then he thought it was 21. But we never really see what the dealer's card was, so we don't know. Data, on the other hand, looked like he was playing recklessly. Normally asking for three more cards would be insane, but, you know, what a 5-card Charlie is, I'm not exactly sure. I've never heard that before. But in the end, Data had a 5 and a 2 for 7. His third card was a 3, which brought him up to 10. So it makes perfect sense for him to get a 4th card, which was a 2. That brought him up to a 12. Now, at this point, the only way Data could lose is if his 5th card was a 10, which would have given him 22. So in this case, it made sense to hit again. His 5th card was a 9, which gave him 21. But again, that doesn't necessarily make him an automatic winner. Now, I won't do that for the craps table, because that takes a little more work to figure out. So, anyway, after the players all take their cards or stand, the dealer reveals his hold card. However, in this case, the camera never sees the hold card, so we don't know who actually won. So, I want to go to the casino now. Okay.
So, is it always as glamorous as how they portray it in the episode?
Not really. There's a little too much excitement in there, and that's one of the notes something I have in my notes is that it says okay. First, I say Data is trying to do something that no other gambler can do with the help of Riker. He wins his first hand and tries to get the hell out of the casino, but for some reason, the revolving door brings him back in. And I was wondering, how many shots do you think it took to get that just right? I mean, because it looked like the swinging door was swinging a little bit hard, and it might have hit, you know, one of the actors in the touche once in a while.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. But these guys are professionals. I'm sure they maybe that's why there are only 3 people down on the That's why there are only 3 people on the away team this week, because, you know, there are only 4 compartments in the swinging door, and you have to have at least one of them clear as you go round.
Right.
Otherwise, you would have had a queue.
I can imagine hearing, "Damn it, Franks, cut it out! Revolving door, take 27. So anyway, now Data is trying to get someone to tell him another way out of the casino, and this is why you're saying, is it so lively all the time? But it would appear nobody can hear him. That's normal. You would think it's part of the story that no one could see him, but actually that's the way life is in a casino. People are so paranoid of you causing them bad luck by talking to them that everyone avoids human contact at all. It's very interesting, but it's very true. I mean, there are people that line up little trolls along their machines to give them good luck.
Mm-hmm.
There's something inside, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called the random number generator. So basically, exactly, you know what it is. The only thing that the whole slot machine that's 5.5, 6 feet, 7 feet tall comes down to a little microchip called a random number generator. And all it does is it sits there and calculates numbers through its entire life. And the only time it ever stops is that millisecond you press the button or the contact of the arm comes down. And whatever that number was on at that exact split second determines the outcome of the game. So all of the little is useless. It knows whether you won or not as soon as the electrical contact made contact in the machine. So having trolls or rubbing the machine or licking it or something means nothing in the end.
By the way, I could probably bore every single person listening whilst talking about random number generators. I will refrain from that. But it's a fascinating field of study.
Oh, I could never. I can never get my mother to understand that. You know, she said you could be sitting on a machine for an hour, you get nothing. You stand up, someone sits down, and they hit the jackpot. No. That does not mean if you had just gone one more time, you would have hit the jackpot. Had they actually taken a second to scratch their hand and then hit the button, they would have had a completely different outcome. So, but Chief, why don't you tell us just a little bit about what's fascinating about the RNG?
One fascinating thing about it is that then there's no such thing as a random number generator.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's not possible for you to properly create a random number generator. So the best you can do is, you know, technically it'll be called a pseudo random number generator, which means certain properties that you'd like to have of random numbers, which means, so the properties what you kind of want is that all numbers get represented more or less equally, but that's not good enough. There also has to be no like serial correlation, which means, you know, I can give you a random number, or I can give you numbers that are equally likely by just giving you 2 and then giving you 3 and then giving you 4 and stuff like that. So when you do random numbers, you have to make sure that they all come out equally likely, but also there's no serial correlation. So a 2 can't naturally follow a 3 with any more bias than like a 7 would follow a 3. So they have all of these algorithms that are in place that try their best not to have any predictability behind them. But every single one of them does rely on an equation that's inherently predictable. Now, the question is, it is very hard for you to, what you end up doing is if you wanted to predict the next number, whenever you're generating random numbers, you would have to have a very, you would have to take a long time to sample all of them to effectively know where the sequence is going. So in a way, if you don't have direct observation of an infinite number of numbers, you kind of guarantee that you don't know where the path is going. But in all cases, random numbers are entirely deterministic despite their name.
Really? That's fascinating. Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with a television show called Press Your Luck.
No.
Okay. Basically, it's a checkerboard, kind of like a checkerboard, only the outer edges of the checkerboard are random pictorials. And what it is you press your luck as a game show, and you answer the questions, and you get so many spins. And as this board is, you get everything from like $50 or a vacation, but the one thing you don't want is a whammy. Because it takes all your money and it humiliates you. So you're sitting there, big bucks, no whammies, and stop! And you hit that button, and wherever it's at, whatever that light is on, is where that's what you win or that's what you lose. And the reason why you were mentioning the predictability of the algorithm, somebody actually studied that board, I mean, frame by frame, and knew exactly when it was going to start hitting 2,000 plus a free spin. He was hitting 2,000 plus a free spin. And it was 2,000 and a free spin. I mean, this guy actually took him to the cleaners. And from that point on, they actually had to come up with a truly randomized board. So that's just a side note. So anyway. Okay. So now here's an interesting point. Well, we go back to Mickey Boy, Mickey D and the Bellboy and the gun. So
actually, Lou, just one thing before we get on next. Let me just roll back to the bit where you realize that the guys can't get
out. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right. I did miss a few.
No. So when you, in my opinion, I kind of did raise this a little bit earlier on, but when the when it's clear that Riker and Data and Worf can't get out, I hear what you say about them not being able to speak to people being part of the casino mentality. But as a viewer who was not familiar with casinos watching it, I feel that this particular bit where they're trying to get attention and they can't get attention, and they can't get out, and the way also the music behaves at this point, I was certainly starting to feel very kind of claustrophobic and trapped in this, in this world, and I thought it was very effective the way that they had done this.
Right. Yes, I agree with you there. Then we have Worf. He tries to manhandle a bank of slot machines, which I thought was very interesting because I would imagine security would be all over. But I didn't see any security in there. Did you?
No, not really. I mean, okay, so if the the object here is to be to be thrown out of the casino, then perhaps you could start stealing stuff and you'd be thrown out, or start just making a bit of a ruckus and you'd be ejected from the premises.
That's so true. Get drunk and cause a stir and they'll toss you out. Okay, so the crew is trapped, which Deanna mentions to Picard. I mean, Captain, it's situation's changed down there. Commander Riker, he's feeling closed in, trapped. But first, we have to get the bellboy out of the way, getting his gun out of the drawer, because he's not afraid of Mickey D. But, we did establish that already. And then we move to Data's tricorder, which couldn't read anything a little bit ago. Okay, none of these people were exhibiting any DNA, but now all of a sudden he can read DNA human DNA in an upper level of the hotel. So they take those turbo lifts.
I love the reference to turbo lifts. I really do.
Now, I've got to ask you a question. I don't think it's going to be embarrassing for you because we're all Trekkies here, right? Have you entered an elevator, or do you call them cars, or do you call them elevators?
So you mean a lift?
A lift.
A lift. Something that goes from one floor to the other is a lift.
Yes. So when you enter your lift, do you ever just yell out, deck 15?
No.
Oh, you're lying.
No, I never have. I never have. I work in an office block, and I have to go up, various flights or various floors each day. Mm-hmm. There are generally people in there with me, and I'm sure we're also being watched by security. But I've never shouted out deck 50 or bridge or anything like that.
Mm. Well, I guarantee you, when you go to work on Monday, you'll probably do that now. You at least think about it. Oh, Lou, what have you done?
I might think about it.
You might think about it, and then you'll just laugh and. What the hell's wrong with you, mate? Nothing. You'd have to listen to my show to understand. Okay. Me neither. I've never done it before. So they enter the hotel room and they find a dead body. He's been dead for 283 years, and the lack of any advanced decomposition is due to the sterile environment.
It looked pretty advanced to me.
Yeah, he was pretty crushed in.
But I'm not a medical doctor,
yeah. Dude. But I just have to ask, what sterile environment are we talking about?
Well, I mean, I suppose I got the impression that basically what he was trying to say here is that, the lack of rats meant that he hadn't been eaten yet.
Ah, okay. Because I wasn't sure if maybe housekeeping comes by and keeps the room clean and maybe dusts him off from time to time.
Well, they certainly phoned up a little bit later, right?
What was that about? I mean, they're probably... That was the first time they've gotten anybody on the phone for 283 years to let them know the kitchen was open 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, let's talk about the flight suit he finds in the closet. At the time, I had no idea. I didn't get the reference. I didn't get the patch, any of it. Do you know what the patch is all about on the flight suit?
Okay, I do because I have read it, but I didn't know it offhand.
I didn't either because of the fact I actually, until I did this podcast, until I wrote the notes out for this show, I correlated with they're calling him Stephen Ritchie, but yet on the patch, it's hard to make out the first one. Kind of looks like, you know, Cernan. Obviously, it's Cernan, Evans, and Schmidt. So Ritchie was not on there. And I thought, why is that? And so I looked up Evans and Schmidt, and that's when I came across Apollo 17. And obviously, I was way too young to know about the Apollo missions, except for what I know of 11 and 13. And I did. Oh, God, this was stupid. I actually went to a movie called Apollo 18.
Okay, now I am aware of Apollo 18, and I have not seen the film, but I knew of it because it was a relatively cheap production, or at least an indie production that was in play for a number of years before it managed to get released. And I thought that it sounded like a really quite good idea at the time. I thought that the one-liner, which was that we went back to the moon and we found someone there, and that's why the Apollo program, effectively stopped.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting, but I haven't seen, the film itself or the execution.
I don't know. It actually angered me, to be honest. I don't know why. I hated it. I hated that movie. So anyway, I don't know if the writers screwed the pooch on this or why they couldn't come up with their own patch. I mean, they just rubbed out Apollo.
Yes, that's apparently true.
It don't make sense. They kept the Roman numerals for 17, but they just rubbed out Apollo. That's just kind of like cheap, I think. So Picard finds out that Ritchie was on the ship, the Charybdis, that had a terrestrial launch date of July 23rd, 2037. Okay, so I guess does that mean that somewhere between 18 years from now, the United States will gain two more states? I don't know. I mean...
No, I think so. I think so. And you're assuming here you're not going to lose any states. So you might gain four and lose two.
That's true. Yeah, we...
But yeah, net, you gain two states.
We gain two states. I don't know. Maybe we can overthrow Iowa if we really put our minds to it. It's possible. Okay. So anyway, maybe they ran out of money and they couldn't do a different patch. So Picard and Riker talk about how they're going to get them out, and that's when the phone rings. And I have to wonder, do you think that phone rings every day and no one answers? Obviously.
The phone is ringing. The phone will be right there.
I think it must, yeah. Otherwise, it's just too coincidental that Worf was there to answer the phone. But I have to say, I've been saying this a lot this episode. I probably shouldn't, but I think that Worf is funny.
Yeah.
And I like his interaction with Data, and then I like the way he, he says no in a very stern manner. Yeah. And then he says, the kitchen is open 24 hours a day, and they look slightly baffled, as if they've not quite understood what room service was. And I love all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so Picard and Troy read the book on their Kindle and start out with Kindle. It was a dark and stormy night. Now, on another side note, I'm sure my daughter's not going to like this, but when she was very, very young, we would always read her a bedtime story. and she always wanted it to be a ghost story. But we could never start out with, it was a dark and stormy night. It was too scary for her. So we always had to start out with, it was a bright and sunny morning. You know, this particular ghost story happened on a bright and sunny morning. Then we tell the ghost story that, you know, everything about light, everything light and fun. So, you know, that would put her to bed and she wouldn't have nightmares. So I told her about that after I wrote these notes. And then I said, you know, I really want to tell you a ghost story again. To which my 13-year-old said, whatever. No, Thanks, sweetie. Okay. Because then we'd have to sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And then we'd have to say Sweet Dreams. And then we'd wait and we'd wait and we'd wait until she said Sweet Dreams. And then I'd say, only if you're in them.
Oh, that's so cute.
It was. But that was, you know, 10, 11 years ago. No more of that. Okay, so Mickey D enters a casino and has some words with the bellboy. As they agree to take it outside, we switch to Troy and Picard, who apparently got tired of reading the Kindle version and downloaded the audiobook.
why is Picard reading this book at all? I mean, I'm not sure that Picard needs to be in this episode. He, you know, I think the scenes on the Enterprise are unnecessary. I mean, I know that you have to cut the show in a certain way and you need it to be familiar and stuff. And certainly when you're coming back from ad breaks, you probably, you know, you have to be on the Enterprise or at least in space to give it the setting. But Picard doesn't do a huge amount this episode. And if they wanted to understand the book, I mean, did they even ask Data to read the book?
Yeah, because he did.
Data would, so he was able to read the book and he knew what was going on.
Pretty much, yeah. He just, bzzz. Oh, I like that so much, I'll do it again. Bzzz.
You don't really need Troy, right, to be sitting on the sofa listening to the audiobook, getting tired and falling asleep.
Mm-hmm. That's why she leaves and runs to get herself a bowl of chocolate ice cream or something.
And also, if you are consuming it as an audiobook, you would have expected it to be like on 1.5 times speed or something.
Right.
So Mickey D came into the sofa. He should have had a high-pitched narrator.
Right. But you know what I did step over one thing that I was going to mention is that, you know, Troy says, you know, Captain, this situation is different. Riker's feeling tense, closed in. He's feeling trapped. And then when they finally establish communication with them, what does Picard say? Number one, why haven't you left that building? Didn't Troy tell you we're a little trapped? But that's just a nitpick. So just as about Mickey D and the bellboy are about to walk outside, Mickey D pulls out a gun and shoots him in the back. No woman is worth dying for. Killing for, but not dying for. Words of wisdom.
Indeed.
Okay, so let's go ahead and consider wrapping this one up and saying the hotel is going to get bought out by $12.5 million U.S. dollars. Wait. Let me see how much that is in pound.
it's around 8 million pounds.
Really?
Something more or less.
Let's see what Google says. It is 8,281,299.25 British pound sterling. Okay. So how many pounds?
I wasn't far off.
Yeah, you ain't too far off. Hey, what's a few hundred thousand between friends, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, but before they can buy out this place, they have to go hit the craps table. This is where I really start getting into the story. So Data rolls a six, and the point is to roll a duplicate six before hitting seven. So he rolls again, and what's he do? He sevens out. Now, here's an odd thing. I don't know if you noticed this or not, but after he sevens out, the dealers don't pick up the chips. They actually let them roll again.
Is that not allowed?
No. Once you've sevened out, you've lost. They take your money. We'll take that. Thank you. But yeah, they actually, I mean, it's a stack of chips. Texas had a stack of chips. Data has a stack of chips. And they just let them sit there. Oh, let them roll again. Because normally it would go on to the next shooter to Data's left. So this time, Data notices that the dice are improperly balanced. No kidding. And offers to fix them. So after a quick repair, he proceeds to win the baby a new pair of shoes.
By the way, I always interpreted when he quote-unquote fixed them, mm-hmm. he didn't make them fair. He made them so that they would roll sevens or whatever was necessary. I thought that he was fixing them as in he was making them improper, but making them improper in his favor.
No. I took it as these are improperly balanced, as in obviously the casino had an advantage with weighted dice that would mm-hmm. stop at a certain pattern to seven out. I think the casino was actually cheating the people, which is why the manager was absolutely beside himself. The people, you know, they were winning like crazy. But after Data hits 18 passes and has $12.3 million, Riker decides to bet it all, which would give him a $24.6 million. Texas, on the other hand, shows why greed is eternal. He figures after 18 passes, there's no way Data could hit another 7 or 11, so he decides to ride the don't pass. Data said, that's funny, that's not a prudent choice. That's what horse racing is about. So I don't get that horse racing reference. I don't believe that's a prudent choice, sir. Well, that's what horse racing is about. Roll 'em, boy. I mean, I don't get the horse racing. Maybe somebody can explain it.
No, I don't either. Okay. But I think it's in general in character, right, of the Texas dude that he would probably, you know, would probably come off a little bit early.
Sure.
And go against them.
So when Data hits his 19th pass, that just drains the blood from Texas's face. And he claims, you did that on purpose. What? Because I didn't show you my car?
Yeah, I like that. I like that callback from a little bit earlier in the episode.
Which we glazed over.
We did. But it was... I did think it was nice. Because you see the guy and he's like genuinely hurt. That despite Data warning him in the strongest possible manner and he still went against him, he was upset when Data rolled another seven and continued the streak.
Well, that's what horse racing is about. Oh, yeah. That's what I say. If you ever go to a casino, notice the faces when you're going in and the faces when you're coming out. Because when you're going in, the people are coming out and they're always grim. And then when you're leaving, notice how happy people are when they're arriving. So there you go. So if you got no other reason to go to a casino, just check out the gamblers and see what that's like. So Data wants to cash out and broke the bank. So Riker says, take $12.5 million purchase price of this edifice or something and spread mm-hmm. the rest around. Now here's something I thought the assistant manager said that I found very interesting. He said, you're the foreign investors. Why do you think he said that? Because to me, that makes it sound like he may actually be one of the aliens who constructed this whole thing in which the book was based. And he finally found those foreign investors mentioned in the book.
Oh, no, I was under the impression that within the... So first of all, I think everyone in there is like a hologram playing a scene. I thought that as part of the programming of the assistant manager, he would have been probably tipped off that there were foreign investors coming to, you know, to look at the casino and maybe potentially with an interest of buying. Mm. So I thought that it was the case that they probably got wind that... You know, the character probably got wind that there was a foreign investor coming, and he kind of put two and two together when Riker started talking about buying the place. Ah.
So do you think maybe he's now thinking to himself, I shouldn't have been so snotty to them?
I mean, possibly. But by the way, something that we did not talk about at all is that when we find the dead body of the colonel. It transpires that he was on a spaceship. He died. He believes that he was killed by a bunch of aliens for some reason, and they did so by accident. Yeah. And they kind of put this thing together as a because they believe that that's what he wanted. And they studied, the Royale book, or is it Royale or Hotel Royale, whatever it was. They studied the book, and they basically put him into this, in this state where it was like a living hell for the guy, but the aliens thought that this was, you know, a representation of his home life. So, you know, this entire thing exists as a way of saying sorry for like an accident on the original for the original astronaut. Now, having said all of this, right, I don't think any of the escape plan makes sense because there are just too many holes. So Riker sees someone leave the place and he says, well, he left the place because it is written that he left the place. So they then look and they say, well, the foreign investors leave the place, so let's pretend to be the foreign investors.
Right.
Well, that assumes two things. First of all, that there aren't any other foreign investors in the episode, because if it's been put together by the aliens to represent the book, then where are the foreign investors? Why aren't their character there? Why aren't they arriving? I mean, are we assuming that the aliens wrote the horror novel as to be adaptive to whatever people happen to stumble into the episode? So I don't understand why Riker and co. take the role of the foreign investors and the foreign investors aren't there to begin with. You know, why didn't they take Mickey D's role, for example? Mm. Had they killed the bellboy, could they have walked out? Mm. And then the other thing is that I just don't think that I just don't see why the program would allow you to walk out on this if you've managed to do something as part of the game or part of the Hollow novel, but you wouldn't be able to walk out normally. Mm. To me, it just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, I go along with it because I like to see Data, you know, gambling and rolling, and I think it's a quite nice ending.
Yeah.
But to me, it makes no sense at all.
Do you think maybe Colonel Ritchie was playing out the same scenario but just didn't figure it out like Riker did?
Well, I mean, even if Colonel Ritchie had, right, what's he going to do? He's going to leave it and then end up in a black room without any, you know, at least Riker and Co. have a spaceship to go to. So I think that there was no escape for the Colonel.
Right, yeah. He would have just went back in and stayed there, I guess.
And actually, the one quote from his diary that I really like is when he realizes that it's been based on the book, he says, you know, for it was such a badly written story filled with endless cliche and shallow characters that I shall welcome death when it comes. And if I were a harsher man, I would have replaced the word story with episode there.
Right.
But I like the story that fundamentally we don't really see. I like the story of the aliens doing this as a way of, you know, as a way of recompense.
Yeah, I think I'll put in that log entry. We don't put in a lot of audio on this show, so I think I'll put that in as fun because I thought it was a pretty good entry as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I write this in the hope that it will someday be read by human eyes. I can only surmise at this point, but apparently our exploratory shuttle was contaminated by an alien life form which infected and killed all personnel except myself. I awakened to find myself here in the Royal Hotel, precisely as described in the novel I found in my room. And for the last 38 years, I have survived here. I have come to understand that the alien contaminators created this place for me out of some sense of guilt. Presuming that the novel we had on board the shuttle about the Hotel Royal was in fact a guide to our preferred lifestyle and social habits. Obviously, they thought this was the world from which I came. I hold no malice toward my benefactors. They could not possibly know the hell that they have put me through. For it was such a badly written book, filled with endless cliché and shallow characters. I shall welcome death when it comes.
Understand, number one. Now we know why all that is there. Why can't you get out?
So now the away team leaves the building without signing any papers. And I couldn't help but think of a piece of the action.
I see where you're coming from on that. Mainly because I've read the Memory Alpha page, like after I had reviewed the episode, When I was watching the episode myself, I wasn't thinking a piece of the action, but then it is referenced in Memory Alpha, and you know, as this, there are similarities on the storyline, but for whatever reason, I just didn't. You know, that wasn't where my mind was at.
Oh no, I was just thinking about piece of the action is now the Federation owns this piece of this hotel. I guess I don't know. I didn't read that in Memory Alpha. I'm looking at it now, and I'm not sure where it's at, but that's fine. Okay, well then, I guess that's pretty much everything.
Yep, then I think that we've got to the end of this one.
Okay, well then, it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. Technically speaking, as I said at the offset of this episode, this might actually be one of the weaker stories in TNG. It's not as bad as others, but somehow I get the impression I should not have liked this. It was just cliche-ish, like Colonel Richie says. But actually, I do. I love the casino aspect of the story. I like the mystery of how the 21st century human could have possibly ended up so far from Earth. And I like that it was all based on the cheesy book that was really written with bad characters and terrible cliches. Now, I don't know why my notes cut off at this point, but the original writer of the story, of this episode, was a little perturbed that the story was changed, and as most people say, the original version probably would have been better. I don't know. I don't know what the original version was, so I guess it's hard for me to say whether it'd been any better or any worse, but in the end, I kind of like this. And just a second. And my notes don't have what I gave it a rating for, so I get to redo my ratings. It's not exactly one of the best. It's not one of the worst. It's kind of like, I'm not even sure if I like the middle of the road, but I don't think it's a 4. So even though you don't like halves, I am going to go a 3.5 on this one. What about you, Doc?
Okay, I mean, it's difficult. I watched this episode and I thought, it's great. It did something, and I enjoyed it, and I thought it was a nice story, and I remembered from when I was a child and how kind of like unusual it was and how spooky it was, and it's a kind of like a very weird episode. I think we don't have too many like this out there, and but at the same time, I think objectively you look at it and you think, really, really, is this what? You know, is this what Trek is? And you think, well, it's not really. It's not. But I don't really know what to give it in a way. It's very, very hard. I think, you know, in one side of my mind, I'm thinking, well, it kind of comes in, you know, at a 2 because it's not a particularly good episode. It doesn't really say much. I don't think it's got a particularly, you know, it's not got a good message kind of story that you can then project onto, you know, it's not a social commentary on anything as far as I can see. It's, I think you don't really use the crew particularly well. But on the other side, I'm thinking, well, I should give this a 4 because it was so much fun and I just enjoyed myself. Unfortunately, I'm going to average those two out and say it's going to be a 3, but it's a 3 because on one hand I can see it and enjoy it. On the other hand, I look at it and I think, but it's not really very good. So it's a bit of a weird one here. So I'll come in at a 3 because it's not a middle of the road boring episode at all. It's a wacky out there episode that has a lot of entertainment in my mind, but you kind of look at it and you think, it's also crazy. So overall, I know. You know, despite everything, it's going to balance over to a 3 for myself.
Okay. All right, then.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Today, I am a warrior.
Lieutenant Worf takes part in a savage Klingon ritual. Commander Riker faces a vicious feud with his father.
We could clear the air once and for all.
You're on.
Each one confronts a do-or-die test of courage.
This fight is all we have left.
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Okay, well, join us next week as we review Season 2, Episode 13, and that will be Time Squared.
And don't forget, also, we have a guest for Time Squared. Colin will be on next week. He's been James from London.
And he's been Lou from Nebraska.
And we'll see you next week. Thank you for dumping.
Good night.